Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The French embrace their right to protest, and that has been very clear lately. Millions in the streets of Paris and beyond protesting the French government push to raise France's retirement age to 62. Roads blocked and much more. It's been something to see. This hour on Point, we'll look at the rage over retirement in France and at the debate here at home over when Americans should be eligible for Social Security retirement benefits. You can join the conversation. What do you make of the millions and the riots in the streets of France? Will it, could it happen here? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll look at the debate over raising the Social Security retirement age in the U.S., but here's France. Throngs of French youth there rampaging in the streets of a Paris suburb, part of a retirement age demonstration. French retirement police confronting them, you hear, beginning to fire tear gas right there. Joining us first today from Paris is Stephen Erlanger, Paris bureau chief for the New York Times. Steve, thanks very much for being with us.
Happy to do it.
This has been something. How long since France has seen anything like what we've all seen in the last week or 10 days, Steve?
Well, there have been 4 or 5 days like these days over the same issue. There were big demonstrations when I wasn't here in 1995, which caused a pension plan to get derailed. But this is pretty big, but it's diffuse, and it's not millions and millions. It's, at the highest days, it's between 1 million, according to the police, 1.1 million, and 3.5 million, according to the unions. Right now, we're in this period of strange stasis where lots of things are blocked. Gasoline is very hard to find. Most transport is going, 3 of every 4, 1 of every 2. And the Senate is working through endless amendments put up by the socialist opposition to try to delay the vote. The unions have called for another big day of demonstrations next Tuesday. There was a big day last Tuesday. Mm-hmm. And in general, you have a lot of people who don't like Sarkozy, are fed up with the sense that somehow the system is unjust. We've moved beyond pension as an issue, I think.
How much of this is popular support or resistance, Steve? How much is union demonstration, or is there a difference in France now?
Well, France is actually a very ununionized place. I mean, people differ, but I think only between 4 to 8% of the workforce is actually unionized. But the unions are strong in key choke points for the economy, and the CGT, which is the biggest union and was affiliated with the Communist Party, had a kind of almost revolutionary strategy. It made itself strong in fuel depots, on the railways, in the electricity plants, in the transport unions. And when the CGT is acting on strike, it begins to choke off the rest of the society. And that's what's been going on. I mean, there are a lot of French who are sympathetic to the strikers. Maybe 70%, 60 to 70% of French sympathize with the strikers. About half of the French, according to the polls, actually support the strikers. But there's also becoming an increasing backlash against some of the violence on the edges of the strike, which probably has nothing to do with pensions and has more to do with kids acting up and enjoying knocking heads with the police. I mean, we're way beyond here the issue of whether they're going to retire at 62 or not.
Well, Steve, do the French feel strange, you know, seeing all this go on in the streets of their country, while across the English Channel, the British are slashing right and left, just really cutting back in a big way on government? Do the French, I don't know if you can talk about the French people, but will France be able to stick with its social welfare system while all the stress is on? You see its neighbor cutting?
Sure. I mean, they really are different countries. The Anglo-Saxons mm-hmm. are different from the French and the Italians and the Greeks. And the French had a revolution of a different kind than the American one and the British one. And the idea of the streets of the Paris Commune is very important to French self-identity. I mean, a lot of French imagine themselves, you know, they have to be out in the streets once in their lives. It's like a rite of passage. And I say this not to be patronizing. It's just a different idea of what it is to be a citizen. And people do feel that a right that they had won under the socialist governments in the 80s are now being taken away from them. And they are less convinced that it needs to be done for demographic and financial reasons than the Anglo-Saxons, because basically the British had the big real estate bubble,
right,
as we did in America, mm-hmm, and the French did not. I mean, the French had banks were perfectly fine. You have to put down 20% if you want to buy a place,
mm-hmm,
here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they didn't have the kinds of distortions that the British had, so they don't feel the same sense of responsibility or guilt, and they are very reluctant to take on faith this notion that demographic reasons means that they have to give up social benefits won before. Now, that logical or not, that's how a lot of people feel.
When does the vote come, Steve, and how's it look it's likely to go?
Well, once it comes, it will pass because the government has majorities. I mean, the Senate is expected today or tomorrow to vote a key part of the change, which is to raise the upper age for full retirement pensions from 65 to 67,
mm-hmm,
then there has to be a period of reconciliation between the two houses of Parliament, and most people expect a final vote by the middle of next week, but there's again going to be more aggravation and probably another big strike next Tuesday. So things are still in play. What the government is trying to do is to hurry things up in the Senate, but that also accelerates this notion that somehow they're pulling over something on the people without full discussion.
Stephen Erlanger, Paris Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Steve, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Here we go to the streets of, where is this? Well, France, in just the last couple of days. There you go, middle and high school students near the Prime Minister's residence in Paris saying, what do the people want? Resistance. Why are we protesting? Resistance. And here's the General Secretary of the General Confederation of Labor, one of France's five big unions, taking the French leader Sarkozy to task for not bringing union leaders into discussions over the whole retirement age earlier. This is on Tuesday.
Mr. Sarkozy decided to increase the retirement age without a debate with the unions, so it's not surprising the whole country is paralyzed by blockades.
Millions one way or another, here and there, in the streets, not everybody likes it. Here's a 65-year-old Frenchman, Alain David, telling NPR's Eleanor Beardsley he knows things have to change.
I'm very angry against the unions who are manipulating people. France has a huge deficit, and if we don't reform our retirement system, we're going straight into a wall.
Straight into a wall. Here's the French Prime Minister. This is François Fillon on Tuesday speaking out against protests crippling the country in a speech to the French Parliament.
L'intimidation, le blocage,
the intimidation, the blockades and the violence goes against democracy and the social contract.
Joining me now from Washington is Philippe Aguillon. He's a professor of economics at Harvard University, focuses on economic growth, development, has concerns about the Sarkozy plan to raise the retirement age in France. Philippe Aguillon, thank you very much for being here.
Hi. Hello.
Hello. So what is going on in your country?
The movement that's going on in France and the way it has broad support, it's because it comes, you know, it came in a way. Sarkozy didn't have this reform in his program in 2007.
Uh-huh.
So it was not announced. In fact, when he was elected, he said that he would not reform the retirement system. He made a statement that almost committing himself not to touch the retirement system. So in fact, what he's doing now is reneging on the promise he made when he was elected.
Of course, in between, we've had economic meltdown around the world. We just heard Steve Erlanger saying France is
absolutely
different. Can France afford to sustain its...
No. So of mm-hmm. course, now people understand that, you know, the current system is unsustainable. Now, one thing about the current system, some people believe, you know, many observers abroad believe that, you know, the existing law says that all French retire at the age of 60. In fact, 60 is the minimum age at which you are entitled to retire if you want.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, the maximum age is 65. Now, if by the age of 60 you haven't had, you know, like full 40 or 41 full years of work, then you get diminished pensions.
Right.
It's only if you've done these 40 or 41 years that you can retire at 60 with full pensions. Okay, so that's the current system. And many people retire at 65.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's the current thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, everybody acknowledges that the current system is unsustainable due to aging population and the increase in life expectancy. Now, the question is how to solve the problem. So one way would have been to simply increase the number of years that entitles you to get full coverage, you see, from 40 to 43 or something. You
the said? Number of years of working.
Mm-hmm. Of working,
yes,
exactly.
Yes.
And to do it in a way that accommodates differences in penibility across jobs. There are some jobs which expose, you know, more unhealthy than others. You see what I mean? So it could have been nice to have also something that makes it contingent, you know, on the kind of jobs. But this is not at all what the government did. The government imposed a minimal age of retirement of 62 for everybody. And so, for example, someone starting at the age of... And so that has two problems. The first problem is someone starting at the age of 16 now will have to contribute 44 years before he gets to age 60.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about France in an uproar. Uproar over moves to raise the retirement age in France. There we heard the police firing tear gas at demonstrators in Paris just this past Tuesday. A promise of more big demonstrations to come, and they've been big already. But the French government, members of the ruling party, say it's time to do it. It has to be done. Here's Arnaud Robinet, a member of the French ruling party, defending President Sarkozy's proposal to raise the retirement age to 62.
This reform is indispensable. If we don't do anything, or if the government decides to change the proposal, the pension system will hit a wall. It's a question of logic. We live longer, so we must work longer, like the rest of Europe.
France in an uproar over proposals to change the social contract, as many see it there, as we've been hearing today. We'll look later in this hour at the retirement, Social Security full retirement age in the United States and the debate over what needs to happen with that. Philippe Agnon joins us, a French professor of economics at Harvard University. We just heard him say that the current system is not sustainable, but clearly the people in the streets are not happy with what's going on around the change. Joining us right now as well is Newsweek Paris Bureau Chief and Middle East Regional Editor Christopher Dickey joins us today from New York. Christopher Dickey, thanks very much for being here. Thanks for being back with us. Welcome back.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Philippe Agnon says it's not sustainable. So if that's clear to everybody, and I'm not sure if it is, but if it is...
By the way it's done, it's not being fair because those who start working early contribute more years, and those who have low life expectancy contribute more. So it's a net transfer from low life expectancy, mm-hmm. unskilled who start working early, to those who are skilled with higher life expectancy. That's why people find unfair with the reform.
Right.
That's the problem. The idea of increasing the number of years of work because we live longer, that everybody accepts. But the way it's done amounts to a transfer to increased inequality between the unskilled, low life expectancy citizens and the high-skilled, high life expectancy. And that's the problem with the reform.
Christopher Dickey, I mean, that's a marvelous level of nuance. You can see it if you're a ditch digger, and it's hard work, and you started early. Why should you keep doing that while somebody else who began work later, you know, some laid-back job like reporter, Chris?
Not in my case, Tom. This is a hard job, let me tell you.
No doubt. But, to step back for a second, Philippe Agnon and Steve Erlinger earlier are saying, yes, this is about retirement age, it's about fairness. But there's something more going on here, getting all these people into the street. How do you interpret it, Christopher?
The French love to go to the street. You know, Steve mentioned the strikes in 1995 that went on for weeks and really brought the country to a standstill. There was nothing going on in France except the strike for several weeks in late 1995, and it basically destroyed the prime ministership of Alain Juppé and weakened the Chirac government really badly and forced them to withdraw the kinds of reforms that they'd proposed. And I'll tell you, I've never seen the French, or the Parisians anyway, so happy as during that strike. They just loved it. They were rollerblading to work. If they were going to work at all, they were bicycling. They were picking up people in their cars in a manner that showed solidarity that you don't see in daily life. And they didn't really get irritable again, and sort of typically Parisian, until they knew they had to go back to work in a day or two. And then all of a sudden, it wasn't fun anymore.
So there's a cultural, historical affinity, and yet they're not out there for no reason. This is not just a picnic.
No, but they're out there for a lot of reasons. And the pension, everybody knows that pension reform is going to be a big issue. And if people think about it, they know that the socialists were really wildly irresponsible when they pushed the pension age down to 60. To begin with, and just like they were wildly irresponsible a few years later when they declared that there would be a 35-hour work week. All of that was stuff that Sarkozy, he said he wouldn't touch pension reform. Philippe's exactly right about that. But, but on the other hand, it was clear that he was supposed to rationalize the economy and make it sort of more modern and efficient and more in line with other European governments. That was what he said he wanted to do. But people just hate Sarkozy. I mean, he has lower 30% approval rating and sometimes lower. And they see him very much as identified with the rich and the interests of the rich. But there is just also a general feeling in France, it's a little bit like the Tea Party here in the United States, of just kind of inchoate rage at the system. But you also have to know that the French always hate the government. They're not lovers of government. And that's one of the reasons that they're always ready to go into the street.
Christopher, Philippe, let me share a little bit of response we're getting online here. It's kind of across the board. Joe says, you know, I'm all for them protesting. It's a way to be heard. And here's another comment. We have a lot to learn from the French. I guess we Americans, meaning they're the way their citizenry is involved in politics, the way they keep the leaders honest. But then here's another. Philippe, I'll put this to you. Corbyn writes, the French people are getting exactly what they deserve. Since the 50s, they've been quaffing a heady cocktail of Marxist idealism, 35-hour work weeks, 5 weeks paid vacation, bullying labor unions, baffling sense of cultural superiority. They're refusing to believe their system is fundamentally flawed. They have a hangover and believe another bottle of wine will solve the problem. Is the fundamental French social contract on the table now, Mr. Agnon, or not?
Yeah. I think it is. I think France needs to undergo big transformations. I mean, it's absolutely right. You know that you need to have more labor market flexibility, that we need to have people work more. There are key problems with that. The first problem is that people are very unhappy on their jobs in France. There have been various surveys that show that the atmosphere in French enterprises is very bad. There is a very high level of distrust between employers and employees, for example. Mm-hmm. Very few promotion prospects for employees. So that, you know, there's a long discussion why is that the case. But that's, I think, a big obstacle. That's why also people want to leave early to minimize the time in their job because they're not happy in their job. So that's a kind of big structural problem. The other one is that, of course, we need to rethink the social contract. But the question is how you do that. So I think one type of countries that France looks at is Sweden, you know, Scandinavia.
Yes.
Because Scandinavia, they have a social system which has very much a lot of resemblance with the French, but is also very flexible, innovative, and so there is the view that you might be able to, if you ask France to become the US or the UK, I think you are, it's a non-starter. But if you tell the French, look, you could become like Sweden, then you might have a chance to be able to reform. But that's something that Sarkozy cannot do. You see what I mean? Because he does not, he's no Olof Palme. You see what I mean? He's, Strauss-Kahn could do it, but Sarkozy cannot.
He doesn't have the trust. He doesn't have the faith of the citizenry
the faith,
at this
exactly.
point.
Maybe the hope is that Strauss-Kahn could do it if he becomes president or the, you see, someone like that with a kind of new labor, French new labor person, you see, could do with the trust. In fact, during the Mitterrand years, Bérégovoy had done a big reform of the financial markets in 1984. That was pretty much accepted because it was done by the left. In 1997, Strauss-Kahn, as a minister of finance, privatized a lot of firms in France. it was done, it didn't raise any problem because they trusted the government. So you see, there is this notion of trust which underlies any prospect of structural reforms in France.
We'll look at what can be done and how. Let's get to our callers as well. Philippe, Christopher, we've got Louisa calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Louisa, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Tom. And I welcome your debate set in a very good transatlantic perspective or a trans-English channel perspective. Now, I am French, but I've lived a long time in Britain and for a few years now in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And if I had to write an article on this, I would call it A Tale of Two Illusions, not A Tale of Two Cities, as
they call it. Okay, yeah.
Two Illusions. So I'm going to take first, very briefly, the French side and then the American side. The French side, as people have said on your program, is rooted in a revolutionary history, mm-hmm. especially the years 1792, 93, and all the subsequent revolutions. People very willingly take to the street and think that this is their exalted right. But at the moment, though, what often is not reported is that there is an opposition even among young people. For example, there's a movement called Stop la Grève, which was launched by some university students. And also, it's very, very interesting to read the blogosphere, because many of the 2 million French abroad do not perceive at all the situation as many do.
What's the first illusion you're pointing to, Louisa? Right. Take us to it.
The first illusion is that by asking daddy, if you want, or by asking the plutocrats, the rich, which come to cough up and that someone at the head can solve the problem, even if we're strangely, the French actually act as if they were in a monarchy. So the monarch is Sarkozy, and he can by waving the magic wand, everything, the economy is no problem if he
marries. Right. So what's the second illusion you want to lay out, Louisa, quickly?
In America, the Tea Party also completely disrespects democracy. They, too, think that by waving a magic wand, things will happen, and they don't realize that Obama has been elected democratically, mm-hmm. and if they want to talk, they have to talk with this firmly in mind. So that's what I call. And to conclude on the British, they are those whom I admire the most at the moment. They had a very big sense yesterday in Parliament. I could hear of a certain unity, of a strong country which knows how to talk to itself.
Well,
thank you very much.
A momentous moment. Louisa, thanks for your call. Christopher Dickey, are the French protesters living an illusion?
No, I don't think they're living in illusion. That's just they're living in the system that they have. I mean, I think Philippe's right. Everybody sort of knows there has to be a reform, but nobody wants that reform to take away what they see as the gains they've already been given by the system. And the caller was right that they do treat their president as if he's a king, as if he can solve everything, but also as if he's the root of all evil when things go wrong, which is why one of the reasons that Sarkozy's popularity is so low.
What can France afford now? Can they afford something that the United States and Britain cannot? Did they behave more responsibly during the bubble? Philippe says they could be like Sweden, but to American ears, that also sounds like pretty rich stuff. I know Sweden's changed.
Well, look, I mean, I've lived in France for quite a while. I think mm-hmm. one of the big differences is that although you pay an awful lot of taxes in France, you feel like you get an awful lot of services in France.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that happens in America is because everybody's always cutting taxes. I mean, look at California. Any American always votes to cut taxes or almost always votes to cut taxes, and then they wonder why they don't get adequate public services. They wonder why things don't work very well, why the government doesn't function better. That's not really the debate in France.
But I think if I can make a comment with also respect to Britain and what's going on, I think, this crisis has been two opposite views. One has been a kind of Keynesian view, you should just spend, and that will relaunch the economic machine. The other one has been to say, no, cut all spending and go on the monetary route. Cut spending, lower tax, and that will do. My own feeling is that countries need to come to grip with their deficit, so they have to look at ways to reduce deficit, partly by cutting certain kind of spending, but they should not cut growth-enhancing spending. So if you cut on education, for example, or higher education, you are damaging your growth potential. So I think that's a bad cut. But there are other cuts, that you can make. So I think my criticism towards the David Cameron is that he's also cutting on higher education. So I think one should have a kind of middle way between the monetarist approach and the pure Keynesian approach, to have selective or targeted cuts and targeted investments. I think that is an important thing, lesson to take. In France, you mentioned that people pay tax, but in fact, in France, you have a huge problem of tax evasion and niche fiscal. And people can, in fact, high incomes were supposed to pay like 40 or 50%. Mm-hmm. They end up paying 20%. So the big difference with Sweden is that Sweden, when you are supposed to pay 50 or 57%, you really pay 57%. In France, in fact, you have many ways to escape the taxation. So I think in France, there were two ways to restore public finance, is to cut on some spend, type of spending, not on others, and also to increase tax monitoring to make sure that those who are taxed at 50% are really paying 50%. You see what I mean?
Yes.
And that I think would help, would make us go a long way towards, squaring the circle, which is reduce deficit, but at the same time maintain growth-enhancing investment, which I think they're not doing in Britain.
And the government right now talking about exactly that, cracking down on tax evasion as they look to raise the retirement age there. Nick, in Norwich, Connecticut. Nick, you're on the air.
All right, Tom. I guess my point is that for 20, 30 years, the policies all around the world have been slanted very heavily towards the top 5%. All around the world, the 95% are becoming restive. In Europe, they're striking and rioting and doing other things. The incredible here in the United States is that the impetus for change is being directed to put us back under the control of people who caused the problem. And if they get away with it this time, the backlash is just going to be unbelievable. The rich have got to start paying their fair share. They're not, it's not even close.
Nick, I appreciate your call. Christopher Dickey, I mean, you're in the States now. You're in France most of the time. How do you compare the sort of tenor of what's going on here politically with what we see in the streets of France now?
Well, you know, when people are angry, their first instinct is just to attack the status quo. And it doesn't mean that they necessarily have answers for what would replace the status quo, whether a government or the laws or the tax policies. And I think that's what we see going on in both countries. There definitely is a feeling, as there always is a feeling in France, that the French are getting the French rich are getting off easy. That they're coddled. They're basically like the aristocrats in the court of Louis the XVI.
Mm-hmm.
That attitude still is pervasive in France, and it's a little bit less, but certainly up until about 5 or 10 years ago, you know, public displays of wealth were very negative.
The retirement reform is carried by a minister who has been, in fact, very much involved in conflict of interest, because he was
with the richest woman in France. Yeah,
uh-huh. And he was at the same time the treasurer of the dominating party, of the majority party. You see, at the same time. And he had a lot of relationship with the Bettencourt family or the people involved in the Bettencourt thing.
Right.
And did a lot of favors to them. So it was very uneasy, very strange in France that the retirement reform is carried, you see, by a guy, you know, whom in the UK would no longer be in the government.
Well,
I mean, it's a very controversial figure.
It sounds very familiar in a sad way to us here. Christopher Dickey, we've only got a minute. Does the French social welfare system survive this tough economic era we're in now or not? What are you projecting?
I think there'll be some reforms, some moderate reforms. They're going to have major reforms sometimes in the next 3 to 5 years at the very latest. But you can already see them pushing those reforms down the road, kicking them down the road.
Christopher Dickey, Paris Bureau Chief, Middle East Regional Editor for Newsweek magazine, joining us today from New York. Chris Dickey, it's always great speaking with you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Philippe Aguillon, Professor of Economics, Harvard University. Thank you so much for joining us today, Professor Aguillon.
You're most welcome.
Listeners, we're going to turn now to the United States, Social Security, and when retirement benefits kick in here. Some say that's going to have to go up and up. You can join the conversation. Will Americans hit the streets if our Social Security retirement age is pushed to what, 70? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We've been talking this hour about the French in the streets in their millions over the last couple of weeks, protesting French retirement age, at least one of the limits, going from 60 to 62. American retirement and Social Security are also a big, hot issue. And there is a debate going on in this country about what the age for full Social Security benefits here ought to be, where it may need to go to keep everything solvent and running on schedule. We're going to look at that right now for a few minutes. Joining us right now from Providence, Rhode Island, is James Roosevelt. He's president and CEO of the Tufts Health Plan, former associate commissioner under President Bill Clinton for retirement policy at the Social Security Administration. And, yes, he is grandson of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. James Roosevelt, thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be with you again, Tom.
And with us from Washington, Douglas Holtz Aiken. He's now president of the American Action Forum, former chief economist for the Council of Economic Advisors to President George W. Bush. Douglas Holtz Aiken, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Douglas, let me come first to you. Then we'll hear from the grandson of FDR. Do we need to raise the retirement age, Social Security benefits, in this country?
There are two real reasons that people advocate a higher normal retirement age. Reason number one is to bring the program back into alignment with the life expectancy of the typical American. If we were to put Social Security for the 21st century with the same retirement age based on life expectancy that we had in the 20th century, we'd raise it up to about 70. People are living longer. Moving the retirement age slowly to 70 would divide work life and retirement life more closely to what it was originally envisioned in 1932 when it was invented. The second is obviously the financial stresses on the system, and if you have a system where people work longer and are on retirement benefits for a shorter period of time, that takes some of the financial stresses off the system.
James Roosevelt, your grandfather, FDR, brought it in, one of the biggest social programs in American history. Millions of Americans count on it. Millions will count on it, but we've got structural issues, we're told all the time. Do we need to raise the retirement age?
Well, you know, Tom, when Social Security was enacted 75 years ago, and this is its 75th anniversary, mm-hmm. over half of all Americans over 65 were under the poverty line. And now we're down to just about 8%, even in this recession, great recession. The Social Security has been adjusted about 10 times since it was enacted 75 years ago. The last time was in 1983 when a commission appointed jointly by President Reagan and Speaker Tip O'Neill, back when Democrats and Republicans worked together on these things, came up with some recommendations to make sure that Social Security could pay full benefits throughout the baby boomer retirements. And the director of that commission was a little-known economist named Alan Greenspan, and they came up with recommendations that Congress enacted and the president signed that moved the retirement age to the normal retirement age from 65, which it was then, to 66, which it is now, and will raise it to 67 over the next dozen years or
right.
so. So we're on
for those born in 1960 or later, I believe.
Yes,
mm-hmm. Okay.
That's correct. So we're on that path now. Douglas is right that raising the retirement age would be a way to cut benefits. But it is also, I think, quite unfair because people who are 68 or 69 or 70 are in very different states of physical condition these days. Some mm-hmm. Particularly those who work behind a desk, like you or me or Douglas, could easily keep working till 70. Others who work construction or do daycare or teachers may find it very hard to continue working at that point.
So it's not that easy. Let's hear from a listener on just that point. Chris in Webster, Massachusetts. Chris, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Just to follow up on what your last speaker was just saying about people who work construction and do long-hour days and stuff like that won't be able to enjoy any retirement if they do have to retire at 67 or so. I was telling your screener about an article in the New York Times a couple weeks ago about some of these people in Congress who was trying to raise the retirement age, and the writer was talking about, some of these guys doesn't even do any heavy lifting or anything like that. Most of their appointment is made by somebody else, and I can't see how they're, you know, in their mind trying to make people like me. I'm a truck driver. I'm on the road right now, and I don't see where I'm going to be driving a truck for until I'm 67.
Or 68, or 69, or maybe the beginning of 70. Chris, I appreciate your call. Douglas Holtz-Aiken, how about it? You know, Chris is looking at people who don't even lift the appointment book, let alone do the heavy lifting. Do we have a choice here? Do you see a fiscal box that is going to force us to raise this age, Douglas, or not?
We certainly have financial pressures in Social Security that are widely recognized, and it's important to move now to secure this system for the long term for retirees of the future and our children. I think the most important thing to recognize is that no sensible Social Security reform simply raises the retirement age. It's done as part of a number of other changes to address exactly this issue, among other things. The first is you don't raise the early retirement age. People will still be able to retire at 62 if they need to or desire to, and their work history drives them to that.
On less than full benefits there.
And the second piece is that the minimum benefit is often increased even as the retirement age is raised, as the benefit rates for high lifetime earners are reduced, and as the system is brought into financial balance. You have to take care to make sure that those who are most reliant on Social Security are not harmed by that reform. And the last piece is, it is widely recognized that we have to go back to the original vision of retirement income in the United States, where Social Security was one part, but private saving and private pensions were the remaining two legs on that three-legged stool. The latter two have been badly missing in America in recent years, and we need to make Social Security reform a pro-saving, pro-pension event.
James Roosevelt, is there a fairness issue here? If you do heavy physical labor by 62, maybe, you know, you're done, at least done with that. But that would mean retiring on less than a full benefit. Do we need to make Social Security more nuanced somehow to pay attention to the lives people have led, or is that too complicated?
Well, you know, if you retire at 62 now, you take about a 30% cut in benefits for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And as the retirement age goes up to 66 and 67, that becomes more of a one-third or 35% cut. So if you raise it up to 70, you could be talking something like a 40% cut in benefits. The average Social Security check is around $1,200 a month. You do a 40% cut in that, and there's not much there. And Douglas is right. Social Security was designed to be one leg of a three-legged stool, but it was designed to be the secure foundation for a decent retirement. Then employer pensions were supposed to be added to that. Well, we all know that only about 20% of Americans, the majority of them, government employees, still have employer pensions, some unionized employees, but only about 20%, so that's not much these days. And recently, during the Great Recession, savings have gone up, but it is true, private savings need to be an important part of retirement, but not instead of, it's in addition to Social Security.
Let's go to Kevin in Mount Vernon, Iowa. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Great discussion, one we desperately need to have. I think in the Western world, we're in some sort of grieving process, and we went past denial and anger, and we're right into tantrum phase.
Mm.
And the tantrum over basically what we've come to expect for 40 or 50 years, which is an endlessly growing set of benefits, a social welfare net that's not sustainable anymore. And the U.S. government is borrowed to the max and is having trouble borrowing money. And most of the Western nations are seeing that they're going to have to reduce their social safety nets because of financial reasons. And the public just hasn't caught up to that yet. And my other point is, another caller said that, you know, the rich have got to pay more of their fair share.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not by any sense rich. I don't make six figures unless you count the pennies.
Okay.
But the so-called rich are paying 70% of federal revenues now, so you're not going to that well. And I think what we're having trouble accepting is that what we've come to expect simply isn't going to be. And the final point I'll make is that with a globalized world, there's 2 billion people in emerging economies who are just as smart as we are and will work for 20% of what we will. And no Obama or Sarkozy can change that.
Kevin, I really appreciate your call. James Roosevelt, what about it? The social welfare net that we have come to expect is not sustainable, Kevin says. What's your response?
Well, it's important to remember that we're in kind of a middle place for, among industrialized societies. The French are rioting in the streets, as you were discussing a little earlier, about raising the retirement age from 60 to 62. We're already at 67 under our current law. So, you know, we've done a lot of the adjustments that other industrialized countries are already talking about. And the key factor here is that Social Security has its own dedicated funding stream. It's totally designed to be actuarially sound and kept that way by the actuaries and the trustees that report every year, just issued their report about a month or 6 weeks ago for this year, showing that it can pay full benefits with no changes through 2037, and then if we didn't make changes, and I agree with Douglas that we need to make small changes, there'd be a 22% cut in 2038, so it would still pay 78% of current benefits. But you know what's really surprising is that in this election season, all of a sudden you've got candidates from the Republican Party and the Tea Party promoting privatization of Social Security, where everyone thought that after President Bush's disastrous attempt to privatize Social Security and thereby destroy its actuarial soundness, that was dead. Just 5 years ago, that looked like it was dead. And now they've changed the term. The Republicans are now calling it personalization instead of privatization, but they are promoting it again.
Douglas Holtz-Aiken, when you look at the numbers, you advised President George W. Bush. Do you favor privatization of Social Security? Do you agree that would destroy the sort of actuarial soundness of it, as it stands today?
No one is proposing privatizing Social Security, and any claims to the contrary are just exaggerations.
Well, that's just simply not true. We've heard many people propose that over the years.
There was never a legislative proposal. I mean, there is no...
I've heard American politicians talk again and again about moving more of responsibility to Americans and having them do their own private savings.
Actually, I heard
that's not privatizing Social Security.
And Paul Ryan talked about that last week.
Okay, sorry, Mr. Holtz-Aiken.
He said that Republicans are planning to privatize Social Security. It's not true. There have been proposals to increase private saving. That's true. There have been proposals to allow an option in Social Security for individuals to enhance their private saving.
In lieu of...
But that is not privatizing Social Security, which is the defined benefit annuity that the Social Security system provides. And that annuity should be the heart of the conversation. As Mr. Roosevelt pointed out, the defined benefit system in the private sector is now a history. It's gone. Our experiment with that in the private sector is over, and we're not likely to see it to return. So the Social Security annuity is the only defined benefit left in the American retirement system.
So does that mean it should go or that we need it more than ever?
It should be preserved for the future.
Mm-hmm.
And so the key here is to recognize that we have overpromised on that. The Social Security's problem is very simple. Under current law, the benefits promised will rise to about from about 5 cents out of every national dollar to about 7 cents out of every national dollar and stay there as far as the eye can see. That's the retirement of the baby boom. The dedicated revenues are about 5% of our economy, 5 cents out of our national dollar. So we have a gap, as far as I can see, 7 cents in promised benefits, 5 cents in promised taxes. We have to bring those into alignment somehow. And proposals on raising the retirement age, proposals to have affluent Americans get a smaller retirement benefit out of the government, are simply attempts to bring those into alignment over long periods of time as part of a broader reform of the American retirement system, and that is at the heart of the discussion. And I think the privatization thing is a red herring. We have to talk about what we're going to do with the basic Social Security system.
James Roosevelt, President Obama, of course, has appointed this advisory panel to come back to him by December 1st. That's coming up now, on the federal deficit and what should be done about it. Many expect there'll be some recommendation on Social Security right there. The commission's co-chair, former Senator Alan Simpson, recently compared Social Security to, quoting him here, a milk cow with 310 million teats. Not exactly sacrosanct, if you put it that way, I guess. What do you expect to come from this commission? Do you think they're going to say, let's whack away at some part of Social Security, James?
Well, I'd be interested in whether Douglas agrees with me. I think the commission's going to have a very hard time coming to the majority that it's required to have to actually make a recommendation.
You're an optimist.
Yeah, right. Hard time is understating it, perhaps. I do think that that when it looks at what tends to be grouped together as entitlements, the real attention should be paid to Medicare, so where the ability to pay Medicare benefits was extended under the Affordable Care Act to 2024. It had been at 2017, but it's a much more short-term problem. Social Security has not contributed to the deficit, and it really should not. It does need adjustment. I completely agree with Douglas that we need to make small adjustments. What we need to not do is undermine it with full or partial privatization, do things that are not fair across the board, like going to age 70.
We just got 10 seconds. Your grandfather was FDR. Did he think Social Security would last forever?
He intended it to. He intended it to be part of what we as a community of citizens do together to have a decent life with each other.
James Roosevelt, former Associate Commissioner for Retirement Policy at the Social Security Administration under Bill Clinton, grandson of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. James Roosevelt, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Douglas Holtz Aiken, former Chief Economist for the Council of Economic Advisors under George W. Bush. Always good to hear from you. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.